The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the weekly Dharma series.
So welcome, everybody. Those of you who come here regularly will notice that there are some new items on the altar. There is, on the far side, Maha Prajapati, who's always here, and she was the Buddha's stepmother and the first Buddhist nun, and then we have the Buddha. But Jean Haley was teaching a retreat here yesterday. And so Jean apparently left the little buffalo, the bison, that she often brings as a kind of totem animal in Kuan Yin. So we have a wonderfully robust altar this morning. So about a month ago, I was in Hudson, New York for a dearly beloved nephew's wedding. And I grew up in the Bronx and hadn't been back to New York for more than a decade. So my husband and I decided to go to New York City, and I especially wanted to see the 9/11 memorial and the 9/11 museum. And for those of you who've seen it, you know that the memorial itself is just this very, very powerful piece of public art. There are two enormous fountains that are the footprint of each building, the North and South Tower. And from the walls surrounding, the space is enclosed, the square is enclosed, and from the walls, water cascades in. The names of individuals are around the top. The water cascades in, flows, and then goes down to what seems like a bottomless abyss, down into a dark channel. Very, very moving. And the museum is also a really visceral experience. And it's difficult not to be overwhelmed and to mentally relive, you know, where you were on that day, the memories of that day. But of all the things that were there, that were very moving, very touching, what actually surprised me the most and just broke my heart open was this painting, a painting of an American flag with two Brahma cows. Now, those are the cows with the sort of hump on their back. Two cows on the flag, and a silhouette of the Twin Towers between them. And the inscription on the flag said, to the people of America, with compassion from the Maasai. And the text by the painting said that when the Maasai, who live in Africa, both in Kenya and Tanzania, when they learned of the tragedy several months after it occurred, they responded by offering 14 cows. And cows are their most precious possession. Cows are a form of wealth, and they offered 14 cows to the United States in a gesture of condolence. And I was so struck by this gesture of care, offering what was most dear to people who were far away. And there just seemed to be such a purity about it, you know, giving so heartfully, and not worrying about how the gift would be received. And it struck me that there was something really important that I could learn from this. But before I talk about what can be learned, I'm just going to give you a little more backstory about this, because it's a wonderful story of generosity. And the person who told the Maasai about what happened at 9/11, and I think he told them it was like May 2002, was a young man named Kimeli Nyoma. And Kimeli grew up desperately poor. He never knew his father. His mother was alcoholic, unable to care for him. And his grandmother, who often steps in and takes care, had been murdered. So he was really on his own. And he ran away from the village that he lived in because he heard that there was a school in an adjacent village. And it was a school that was under a tree. It was a church school, essentially. And so he stayed there and learned everything he could at the church school, and then eventually wanted to go to high school. And there was a high school in another village that was 9 miles away. And he went to the high school, and he approached the principal, and he said, "I have no money. I have no money for books. I have no money for a uniform. I have no money at all, but I want to learn." And the principal took him in, and so he went to school there. And he was just a very devoted student. And he then decided he really wanted to be a doctor. So he decided he needed to go to America. And some community elders were really impressed with his effort. And they tried to raise some money for him to go to America and study. And just by chance, there was a Washington Post reporter in that area, and the Washington Post reporter heard of this effort of elders, and I think they managed to raise about $5,000 to send this boy to America to study. So the Washington Post wrote a story about this. It was published in the paper, and the University of Oregon offered him a scholarship. And a businessman in Florida offered him a plane ticket. And other people who read this story sent money to pay for his books, for his lodging. And so he came to America, and he studied at the University of Oregon. And eventually that was in 1996 that he went to University of Oregon, and eventually he transferred to Stanford. And his story was really followed by people in Kenya, the Maasai and other people, who are just so interested in the efforts of this this young man to become educated, and how he'd done it just from sort of nothing at all. So in September 2001, the president of Kenya was going to be in the United States in New York City. So he asked for Kamali to come and meet him so that they could talk about what he'd been doing. And that's why Kamali was in New York on 9/11. So he was there the day the towers fell, and he went to Ground Zero, and he said, as a Maasai warrior, he really wanted to help out, but there was nothing he could do. So he returned to his village the next May, and he told the Maasai what had happened in New York, and they had not heard of this. They don't have electricity. They didn't, at that, in 2001 anyway, they didn't have cell phones, didn't have electricity, didn't have television. And he told the elders that it was his plan. He wanted to buy a cow to give to the Americans. And the elders were so touched by his effort of generosity, and so moved by the story of just this unimaginable destruction, that they assembled a herd of 14 cows to give to the Americans. In Maasai culture, a cow is thought to bring peace to its owner. A cow is a handkerchief to wipe away tears. So that's what they did. They assembled this herd of 14 cows to give to America, to bring peace to America, to wipe away the tears. And this story just made me reflect on all the times when I've held back from expressing care or concern or condolences to people. People that I say knew only superficially or really didn't know. And, you know, my own self-consciousness, the social fear that I might sound awkward, something like that just kept me from acknowledging my feelings of sorrow and my feelings of care. And I suspect that this is true for many of us. We care, but we fail to express our care, that we're afraid it's going to be inappropriate or misunderstood. I mean, the idea of 14 cows for Americans, on the face of it, just sounds absurd. But This is what brings peace to people. So I wanted to spend some time thinking with you about what happens when we fail to act on our impulse to articulate our care, to really think about what's going on. Is that failure a gesture of self-protection? When we fail to express our care, our condolences, our concern to someone we don't know well, or maybe even to someone we know well, is it a gesture of self-protection? We don't want to seem intrusive. We don't want to be misunderstood. We don't want to be with those feelings of sorrow. And I suspect it's our own sense of self that gets us in the way. It inhibits our sense of self, inhibits our sense of care. Oftentimes, I, on behalf of Common Ground, go to communities and teach secular mindfulness, not corporations or nonprofits or other places where they're interested in wellness for employees. And I'm sometimes asked, you know, what's the difference between teaching secular mindfulness and what Buddhists do with mindfulness? And when I teach secular mindfulness, and I do this in correctional facilities too, what I mostly focus on is how in practicing mindfulness we get to see our own reactivity over and over and over again. And this is, you know, for most of us, this is kind of our entry into mindfulness practice. We get to see how our minds react. They follow the same sort of rabbit trails over and over again. And we just get to see that. And eventually, just by seeing over and over and over again our own reactivity, it sort of loses its power over us. We're more able, and I find this especially in correctional facilities where I'm working with people over a period of time, that they're able to see something arise and realize that in that very moment of its arising, that they get to make a choice about how they respond. Do they respond in their own regular ways, or do they respond in a different way? And it can be as simple as one offender once said to me, before I did this practice, every night I would just stand on the chow line and think about how am I going to be insulted or disgusted by what I'm offered to eat. And he said, now I just stand on the chow line, right? Seeing that that reactivity, the suffering that that reactivity engenders. And that's a great thing to do. So I have no qualms about teaching secular mindfulness to the ends of the earth. I love doing it. But what we learn in Buddhist practice, what we're directed to when we establish mindfulness and have a practice of mindfulness, is that we're directed to noticing how what the Buddha talked about as the three characteristics of existence arise. We notice dukkha, which is the stressful nature of experience. The suffering, the dis-ease, or the word dukkha actually comes from the idea that the wheel on the axle is kind of off. So it's kind of being out of alignment. So all the time we get to recognize our own stressfulness, dissatisfaction, suffering, and that's just the nature of experience. All the time we're trying to tweak experience to make it better. We notice anicca, which is the impermanent nature of experience. Things are always changing at a micro level and ultimately at a macro level. Constant change. And we notice anatta, which is the, sometimes it's called the no-self characteristic, which is a little misleading. It's the impersonal nature of our experience. You know, you're at work and your boss suddenly just dumps all over you for something that was really minor, this huge dump. And it just happened to be that the boss was having a really bad day, and you just happened to be in a place where it was easy to dump on you. And most of us know from our own experience that we've done this with our families, our friends, that wasn't about them. It was really about us. And so sometimes we can notice how impersonal that is. Or getting a diagnosis of something. You say, I've eaten, I've exercised, I've eaten the right food, I've done all these good things. How is it that I get this diagnosis? Well, sort of the impersonal nature of experience. Causes and conditions come together, things happen. But often when we work with this impersonal nature of experience, what we really find is that we have this tight sense of self. This shouldn't be happening to me. And that we just kind of congeal around this sense of self. It's not that it's not practical to talk about a sense of self. We talk about a self all the time. But what this anatta characteristic gets at is we have this sense of a solid, essential, firm self. And that's really what we need to investigate. That's what I think really gets in the way of our expressing our care. There's a wonderful meditator named Lou Richman, who's a meditation teacher and is out in California. And now I am blanking on the title of his book. But he had encephalitis and was in a coma for months and wrote a wonderful book, and the word Lazarus is in the title, about his experience of coming out of this coma, being totally helpless, about being totally emotional, totally dependent, and what were the spiritual lessons that he learned from that. And this is the way he characterizes the nature of our experience. What we see when we go deep into our mindfulness, we see the suffering, we see the impermanent nature, and we see that that sense of self is not so solid. We see the impersonal nature. And Lou talks about it in this way. Everything is connected. Nothing lasts. You are not alone. Everything is connected. Nothing lasts. You are not alone. And over the past few months, Mark Nunberg, our guiding teacher, has been basing the Dharma talks here on Guy Armstrong's book, Emptiness, A Practical Guide to Meditators. And over the past couple of months, we've really been exploring the insubstantiality of our perceptions, our thoughts, especially as they relate to ourselves. But I think this nails it. Everything is connected. Nothing lasts. You are not alone. It's another way of understanding the core teaching of the illusion of separation, especially the concept of a solid separate self that needs to be defended. When we do our formal loving kindness practice, our metta practice, the strategy in teaching metta, in learning to practice metta, this loving kindness, this friendliness, is we really begin with ourselves. We offer friendship and care and concern to ourselves. And then we expand these basic good wishes first to people who are easiest, the dear ones in our lives. And then when it's established, we move a little further out and we offer it to our friends, and then maybe coworkers, acquaintances. We often practice with what's sometimes called the neutral person or the familiar stranger, someone you see but you don't know, and you don't have positive or negative feelings about that person. So it might be your postal carrier, It might be the most recent cashier you've had at a bank or in a store, the bus driver. Just think of someone that you can visualize, and then you realize, oh yeah, that person too has these same wishes for safety, for well-being, as I have for myself. And so you offer those same good wishes. And then when we have this more established, we move even further out and we offer it to those who are more difficult in our lives, recognizing that all human beings, even though they're acting out in harmful ways, that they basically desire safety, desire wellness, even when their behavior is really self-sabotaging and harmful. And the insight of metta is just this deeply experiential insight that we all have the same creaturely yearnings, to be safe, be well, to live with ease and joy. So this really helps erode that sense of a solid self. We are not alone in what we want for ourselves. This is shared by all beings. And in many ways, it's shared by a lot of our animal companions, wanting to be safe, wanting to be well. So everything is connected. Nothing lasts. You are not alone. And compassion is loving kindness that bears witness to suffering and acts to alleviate it. Okay, so compassion is an extension of loving kindness. And I've been really excited over the past few months to read about some of the compassion studies that have been done. You know, at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, Richard Davidson does all these sorts of fMRI and extensive studies on what he calls the Olympians, like the meditators from Tibet, but also people who have been meditating for a shorter time and asking them to do certain kinds of meditations, also showing them certain sorts of images and watching what shows up on the brain scans. And what he's been able to tell us is that, especially in experienced meditators, where it's most dramatic, but we also see this in people who are somewhat newer to a compassion practice, is that when the mind is in a state of compassion, that the brain produces oxytocin, which is, you know, the hormone, the connecting hormone, the cuddly hormone. You know, when you look into your loved one's eyes, you get this little surge of oxytocin. Parents, or almost anyone holding a baby, gets a surge of oxytocin. I'm told that even, you know, when you and your dog look into each other's eyes, your dog actually might experience a little oxytocin, having this feeling of real connection. So you get this little hit of oxytocin. And you also get a little jolt of dopamine. And dopamine is, you know, energizing. So that someone who is physiologically in a state of compassion primes us to connect and act out of our care. The Buddha also said that that we do loving kindness to get rid of fear. And oxytocin actually diminishes fear. So physiologically, when we're in a state of compassion, we are really primed to act and to act out of care. And it's not that we become submerged or identified with the person who is suffering. You know, sometimes when people, for example, see like an image of someone who's been really badly burned, and this is one of the sorts of images that they use at in these studies because it just produces such a visceral response. Often the response is just, you know, kind of shutting down, not wanting this ever to happen to me, you know, just kind of pushing away. So the amygdala kind of gets hijacked in this. But people who are deeply compassionate, the amygdala has this little movement, sparks, but then immediately moves to compassion. So they don't, it's not like, oh, if this happened to me, wouldn't this be terrible? But it's immediately, this is a suffering being. I care about this suffering being. How can I help? It's really that the self gets out of the way. And this, I think, is what's so important. The self gets out of the way so we can respond skillfully, even when our response is simply the presence of witnessing. We embody and express our care. So a cow is a handkerchief to wipe away tears. So the coda to this story of the 14 cows that were given by the Maasai to the Americans to bring comfort and peace is that on June 3rd, 2002, a U.S. embassy official went to the village, and it involved a plane ride and a long trek over land to accept the gift. And hundreds of people showed up. He accepted the gift, but he wasn't able to transport the cows. And that's partly because in the United States, there are Department of Agriculture regulations about importing cows from Africa. There's also some concern about just physically transporting the cows, if they would be safe given how far they'd have to be transported over land. And also, it would be very expensive. But let us hope that that was not the primary reason. But that the cows were accepted, but they were left in place. And eventually, a solution was found. The U.S. ambassador came to the village on the fifth anniversary of 9/11 to establish Maasai oversight of the American herd. And in perpetuity, and apparently all the cows have a tag on their ears that has the Twin Towers on it, and by 1909, there were actually 35 cows in the herd. But the Maasai are to guard the American herd in perpetuity. And in return, the Americans offer ongoing, every year, 14 scholarships to children for boys and girls to attend local schools. So there are scholarships, money for uniforms, money for books. So everything is connected. Nothing lasts, and you are not alone. So I would love to hear people talk about times when they have had the courage to act on their caring impulses. Because, you know, these sorts of stories just embolden us to do this. When we hear inspirational stories, we think, I could do that too. Because, you know, when I think about this, I think when I first saw that picture on the wall, this flag with cows superimposed on it, I thought, why would they give cows? How would that help? But of course, it was the symbol of comfort and peace. And symbols matter. You know, we know that. Gestures really matter. So I would just love to hear your stories about when this has been successful for you, or anything else that you would like to bring up. But those stories are really, really wonderful. And we have a mic here, and it is being recorded. You could say your name. That would be great. So who would like to share something?
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Patrice. This is small, but it was kind of big to me. Sorry about that. It was about 72 hours ago at work. One of the women the night before got her eyebrows tattooed. That's kind of a nouveau thing, you know. There's a pragmatic thing because you don't have to put mascara and all that. But so she was showing them to us, and they were really swollen, and it was actually real painful. In fact, she said it was more painful than childbirth, and that says a lot, I guess. So. But I could see in her eyes she was frightened at what she did. Her eyebrows were real puffed, and they just stood out. She looked a little more like Mr. Spock than, and some of the guys were kind of beginning to chide her, and I could see the fear, you know, and I just said, her name is Cassie, and I said, I think Cassie's just looking for, I said this out some, I forget the exact word, but more like affirmation or just like it's okay. And then she started to cry when I said that, and it came real naturally, and my sense was first her discomfort and outright fear, because I think she was really surprised her how it looked. Her eyebrows really swelled up, but then just the sense that, yeah, I wouldn't like that either. You know, I just tried to do what I can to just put her at ease, and then later I went down and talked to her about it, and you know, a little bit more, and I'm not too sure about the exchange in terms of its totality. I like to think that I was helpful. She's the sort of person that doesn't show this sort of stuff readily. But I was more of like, I did what I felt I had to do. I felt connected. So, yeah, that's it.
That's great. Thank you. I mean, that connection, that compassion. Compassion for someone else wanting to step in and do something to make her not be so ill at ease, and maybe to prevent people from continuing to sort of, you know, get on the bandwagon of making fun of how she, or teasing her about it, when it sounds like you were really sensitive to the fact that this was not a good time to tease her. So thanks so much. Who else would like to join in? We're there, and then here.
My name is Hillary, and I can just think a few weeks ago I met my friend's friend for the second time, and she was saying how she was kind of depressed and having a hard time even going to work. And so I just reached out to her and shared some times where I felt similar and some things that have helped me. And it was kind of like enlightening to her, because I think there's a little bit of stigma when you don't feel well these days and like with your mood and whatnot. And I felt like she was more comfortable then and kind of built some understanding of what she was going through. So that's what I wanted to share.
That's great. Thank you. Thank you. Over here.
My name is Don, and boy, I'm having a heart-wrenching experience this morning, and just of not being and not really even knowing what to do with it. But it was the article in the Star and Tribune today about a person, a young person, I think she's a teenager, and it was an article on the shortage of healthcare workers, on personal care attendants. And she's stuck up in a nursing home, I think it's up in Champlin. And she's kind of regulated into this nursing home on what time to get up, and she lays there and waiting for people to come and get her up. And she loves all the people there, but she wants to be with her friends. And I think somewhere in the article, too, was saying about how this one person had to give up their transportation in order to get around and just be like other people. There's this huge shortage of personal care attendants, home health aides that take care of these people. And I was just sort of like, oh, you know, that's that. How am I going to respond to this? And somehow can I, you know, what can I do, you know? And I mean, that's kind of as far as it went. But I was just also kind of thinking about, well, just think if everybody in the community that's able to, you know, be able to, that can go grocery shopping or have a car and go places, just think if everybody in the community just stopped by and they said, you know, we'll volunteer, you know, half hour or an hour or something, she'd be able to continue on with her life. And I just thought, well, you know, maybe that's the deal. Maybe that we're here, we're not having any diseases or healthy for the most part. Well, then isn't it our duty then to for those who aren't healthy, then to somehow give some of that back? But that's that connection between being able to express our concern, our anguish, but and or not? Is it just going to be another article in the paper about this healthcare crisis where we're not evidently paying enough healthcare workers enough money? They compared them to being able to go to McDonald's and flip hamburgers. And so that's kind of a question. It's laying out there for the community, and I'm just kind of torn. Like, okay, am I just going to go on as life as usual, or what do I do about this?
That's a great question. And I very briefly saw the article this morning, and there is a shortage of home health care workers. And so rather than just even respond solely to this instance, you know, what would it mean if legislators were to take this really seriously? I mean, it could both work in terms of the pay that people get, what would it take for people to make more money, and also some of you may be aware that a lot of home health care workers who are wonderful health care workers are immigrants. You know, in many of our nursing homes and other facilities, immigrants come and do work that other people do not want to do. What if some of our immigration policies were changed to encourage people were paid more money? I mean, we can both respond to things, and people have different personalities about how they respond, whether they respond individually or whether their expression of care is to work on a policy level. So you can be really creative about that, but I really applaud your effort to respond. And the children are here, so we're going to sing with the children, and then we're going to have announcements. And thank you, everyone, for your kind attention.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.